Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, April 27th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Nice to see you again, Cherry Gregg.
It's nice to be back. Nice to see you too, Avi. It is our monthly Big Fix episode where we hash out solutions to the country's biggest problems. And today, we're talking about energy demand. It's growing fast. In fact, it's skyrocketing. According to a recent report, electricity needs in the United States will jump 25% by 2030 and 78% by 2050.
Between AI data centers, increased industrialization, and more electrification of our homes, cars, and businesses, we are going to put a lot more pressure on our aging grid, which is already buckling under the current load.
Yeah, and to add to that, the fuel shocks from the war in Iran and the prices American consumers are paying at the pump, these have made the question of how to meet and secure our future energy needs all the more urgent.
Of course, some people say the answer is to drill more, build more gas-powered plants, and lean into an all-of-the-above strategy to meet this surging demand. Others argue this is the moment to double down on renewables and transition to a carbon-free future.
And so on this episode of The Big Fix, we ask the question that touches everything from your electricity bill to the health of the planet. How should we power the future? And as usual, we've brought together three experts with different ideas to present their solutions. And so let me introduce them. First, we have Sonia Carley, a professor and faculty director of the Climate Center for Energy Policy. She's also Vice Provost of Climate at the University of Pennsylvania. Sonia, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
We also have Abe Silverman, a research scholar with the Ralph O'Connor Sustainable Energy Institute at Johns Hopkins University. He was the former general counsel for the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities. Welcome, Abe.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Nice to have you again. And Kevin Book is Managing Director of Clearview Energy Partners and a non-resident senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Kevin, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for being with us, our lovely listeners. We would love your Big Fix idea. What's your solution for America's energy future? How should we meet this rising demand? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. So each of our experts has brought two ideas to the proverbial and literal table. And we're going to go in a big cycle and get each of their ideas, starting with Abe Silverman's first idea. And here's what it says in front of me, Abe. It says, get the U.S. back into the business of building big things fast. What do you mean?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right when you talk about the enormous amount of electricity that we're trying to serve right now. The data centers are using entire cities worth of electricity, and yet our regulatory processes and structures are still stuck back, 10 years ago. We used to be able to build things. We used to be able to build big dams. We electrified the United States in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And, we've gotten really complacent in the last 10 to 15 years. It takes often 10 years to build a new transmission line that everybody thinks is a good idea. And when we say it's a good idea, why? Because it reduces the risk of blackouts. It decreases costs. It allows us to connect new clean energy resources to the grid faster. All this really good stuff. And so my big idea is we need to get back into the business of building big, sexy energy infrastructure.
Sexy.
Ooh, that sounds
yeah,
good.
Sexy. I'm there for it. Let's talk about what happens when we don't do this.
Mm-hmm.
The prices go up. I think the dysfunction in Washington that has sidelined a lot of our offshore wind projects are a really great example of how we in this country made it so hard to build anything. And this could be fossil infrastructure. I happen to like clean. So offshore wind is a great example. If we had had an administration policy, federal policy that said, all right, once we've permitted a project, even if we don't love it, we're going to let it go. We're going to let it finish. And that would have, those wind farms would be on the grid today producing clean energy, reducing cost for consumers, because I know all of this is really comes back to pocketbook issues, mm-hmm. And obviously helping the climate. And so, like, you know, what do we need to do to make energy infrastructure great again?
Mm-hmm. But so what are the things that are getting in the way of building things quickly? You mentioned one thing, which is that there's changes in sort of federal policy, but there must be more, Abe.
The problem is there's a lot of them. Mm-hmm.
Not one big one?
I think NIMBYism is one. But I would actually even step back and just say pride in building things is really lacking in this country. We've gotten such into the habit of stopping stuff. Mm-hmm. And we've really sort of forgotten how to come out and cheer for, you know, that new
so it's a cultural and attitudinal change.
There is a lot of social license issues.
Yeah, and I wonder, are there one or two policies that you think could shift to make it a lot easier to build something without all the red tape? Because there's tons of red tape with every project.
Oh, so much red tape. One is we really need to fix our siting and permitting rules. Mm. You know, and this is obviously incredibly salient today because you want new infrastructure built, but you also want to give local communities the opportunity to come in and talk about stuff and talk about their concerns and say what they want and don't want. But so we absolutely need to have a better process where developers go into the local community, build that sense of place that you need to have them welcome that infrastructure in. Mm-hmm. And then once you've gone through and you had all the hearings and you heard from the local communities, just do it. Just build it. Hmm. Put it out there. And I think that sort of continuity that we talked about, where you don't have one administration trying to undo something that the prior administration does.
The jerking back and forth.
The jerking back and forth. And when we think about this, right, big infrastructure, almost by definition, takes more than one administration. Even if we do it right, even if we fix siting and permitting, even if we get our financial house in order, it's still going to take more than 4 years. Mm-hmm. And so we just need to rebuild this bipartisan political consensus that infrastructure is a good investment for Americans, and it's going to pay off in higher reliability and lower costs.
And so, Sonia and Kevin, I want to give you a chance to weigh in. Sonia first, your thoughts.
I'd love to jump in, actually, thinking about jerking around and the shifting or the pendulum swing of administrations. But maybe I'll just start by saying I completely agree with you, Abe. And I think that some of the big infrastructure that is so essential besides our grid is solar and wind, and industrial scale solar and wind, but also residential scale, smaller distributed energy resources. And one of the biggest barriers that I see is the shift in administrations and the shift of priorities, and specifically the present administration putting new barriers in place that weren't in place previously. So my argument would be, get out of the way. Let these facilities continue to develop. I mean, just to throw a few statistics out there, last year, 2025, over 90% of all new builds, all new capacity that was built in the energy sector in the United States was clean energy technology, solar and wind, for example. This year, we're expecting it to be even more. There is a precedent. These are the very cost-effective technologies, so we need to stop putting barriers in place to prevent them. Examples of barriers. Essentially removing permits for solar and wind projects that are in development, telling offshore wind projects that they no longer have the ability to build, forcing coal power plants to stay online. These are a lot of artificial barriers that are being introduced at present that are getting in the way of all of these developments that have been happening.
Kevin Book, I just would love to hear your thoughts real quickly on this discussion about speeding things along.
Well, you won't hear any disagreement from me on permitting and making it faster and better. I think unequivocally it has to happen across resources. I think one of the areas that I would focus on is getting to sort of the depoliticization of our energy discussion. The rocks don't vote, neither do the wind or the sun and the rain, to quote the Blue Oyster Cult. And while we're on the subject, fires, freezes, and floods, they don't care what party you registered for. So we have to have a real discussion here in a way that over the course of my career, I've watched this change. Mm-hmm. If you go back to 2008, in October, the same bill that included the troubled asset relief program from the financial crisis included the 30D tax credit for electric vehicles. It showed up at a time when both parties supported it as a way to diversify our transportation and our mobility needs away from what had been a moment of extreme scarcity, much like the one we find ourselves in now. And it very quickly diverged into a partisan fight where it has been, including through the Inflation Reduction Act and the Big Beautiful Bill. So depoliticization, I think, is maybe one of the meta solutions underlying some of the changes that Abe was describing.
Yeah, and I know we're going a little bit out of order here, but Kevin, I know that one of your fixes was to sort of pendulum proof, and I think it goes right to what Abe was talking about when you're talking about depoliticizing, energy infrastructure and building. Could you lay out your solution here? And I think this is a good little segue to what you were talking about. Could you lay it out for us?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and I think both Abe and Sonia got right to it. When things change, they disrupt investment plans. So all these energy projects we're talking about at big industrial scale have long lead times and they have long lifetimes. And when uncertainty shows up, it scares capital away. It delays project development, it deters investment, and we end up with less, higher costs, more difficulty. So one of the ideas that's come out of the permitting discussion is this idea of permit certainty, which Sonia mentioned, which is that if you have given a permit, then stick with what you've agreed to. I think you could go a step further than that. You could go to policy certainty. So if you've agreed at a legislative or a regulatory level to take on a policy, that policy should stick until the investment can come and earn return for the people who invested in it, to deliver results for the society that benefits from it. The idea should stick around long enough, which means that you should give it enough thought beforehand to make sure that you're serious. Pendulum proofing could require not only minimum durations for policies that are implemented, but it could consist of supermajority requirements for rescinding or, for that matter, expanding policies significantly beyond their original conception.
So let's go through the mechanics of this. Mm-hmm. So let's imagine that an administration is able to muster the supermajority support for further investment in coal. And then another administration comes in and wants to reverse that. Your idea is that they could not reverse it until what? A certain amount of time elapses?
Well, you'd have to have guardrails around change, but you'd also have flexibility for emergencies. You know, coal is not intrinsically bad any more than oil, sun, solar power, or nuclear power are intrinsically bad. They all have trade-offs. And so a thorough, depoliticized debate of those trade-offs, an understanding of what benefits you will get, what environmental requirements you will need, and what sunsets or lifetime expectations you will have, can inform a good decision up front, but then stick with that decision.
I want to just follow up with you on that, Kevin, because a lot of people see, you know, our lawmakers, just our political bodies as being incompetent in a lot of ways because they can't come together to a majority rule or get anything really done. How do you get around that, the gridlock that we're seeing among lawmakers and policymakers, to actually make it such that, you know, to the extent they can create a policy and then actually stick to it?
It's going to take leadership and courage, Cherry, and it's not easy. One of the areas where I think you need to start is to stop demonizing resources, right? There's simply no point doing that because physics and economics don't care what your feelings are. And it gets down to what you're going to do to the environment, what you're going to do to the natural world, and what you're going to do to the economy in which we all live. And that's the point of energy. We don't invest in energy just for energy. We invest in energy for what it does for us so we can do things with that energy. And so it's going to take leadership to get past that. It wasn't always this way. We today enjoy a real abundance of oil and gas, and a lot of it came from shale production, horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing of shale resources. Everybody knew it was there, but nobody knew how to crack. The policies that started to unlock the investment and the development of that resource began in the oil crisis of the early 1980s. They came out of the Carter administration. And it's not a partisan thing that we're all living better than some of the countries in Asia right now that can't get molecules. We're all benefiting in America from that. So leadership and really stopping demonizing resources.
Let me read this comment from Matt, who says, as a child in the 1970s, I remember politicians swearing we should never be held hostage by oil, foreign or domestic, yet here we are again. Non-oil energy is absolutely needed, from micromobility to solar, wind, mm-hmm. tidal, geothermal, and more. I think this is a fundamental tension that I think is going to come up in this conversation over and over and over again, because we're talking about trying to secure long-term investments. We're trying to get to a place where when the political winds change, the priorities don't change. And it feels like what we're trying to do is kind of insulate this whole industry from democracy. I mean, small d democracy. Mm-hmm. I mean, Abe, you scoff a little bit at that, but like that's what democracy is. Part of the baked in idea is that You vote someone in and they get to change things. If you have a parcel of land in your neighborhood, you guys get a say over what happens in that parcel of land. Help me understand how all of this is going to fit into our understanding of American democracy.
Yeah, elections are going to continue to have consequences. I don't think anybody's debating that. The question is, once you get to a certain point where capital has come in and made an investment, are you going to let them follow through? And I think that's where, you know, we as a society have to get back, make energy boring again. I mean, when I got into this industry, I was working for a Republican administration. You know what? I didn't think about it, even though my politics are pretty clear personally. But we somehow have gotten to the point where we are not allowing settled decisions to stand. Yeah. And it is really
Well, I know
hard.
We're not constitutional scholars here, but how do you draw up a law? Do laws exist that say, like, once a certain amount of capital has been invested, now there's no more democratic leverage on the process?
I disagree that it's about democratic leverage. I think it's about where government has approved a project, has gone through the appropriate process. We need to let them finish deploying that capital, and then the market will decide whether they survive or not. I want to put a really fine point on why this matters to allow infrastructure that you may not love to get finished. Because what we're really talking about here is political certainty and higher risk equals higher cost for consumers. When we come in and disrupt something like offshore wind, it is going to make the next generation of offshore investors demand a higher return than we currently have. Mm-hmm. And that is true for everybody involved. I think it's really important, though, that elections do have consequences, right? But we can very easily simply say, once a permit is issued, we're going to let it go forward. And I think it's really important to recognize that the free market has really kind of spoken on this. If you look at most of the capital being invested today, it is in clean energy. Yeah. We have enough clean energy sitting in the regional grid, in the sort of what they call the interconnection queue, which is the list of projects trying to connect, to replace every power plant twice over.
Yeah.
So the capital is ready to deploy in clean energy, and yet because of this political environment we're in, it's just dysfunctional. And absolutely, does that mean you're letting some coal or gas facilities stay online or make their investment? It does, but I think that's a decent trade-off.
Well, we're going to a break right now. We're going to get to Sonia's first idea on the other side of this break, and we'd love to hear from you this hour. What's your solution for America's energy future? Our number is 888-477-9499. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. It's our monthly Big Fix episode today. We're talking about solutions to big problems, and today's problem is how we can meet our growing energy needs in the U.S.
Yes, and our guests today have come with two big ideas, and we've been discussing the pros and cons. Let me reintroduce our panel. We have Sonia Carley, a professor and faculty director of the Climate Center for Energy Policy and vice provost of climate at the University of Pennsylvania. We also have Abe Silverman, a research scholar with the Ralph O'Connor Sustainable Energy Institute at Johns Hopkins University. And finally, we have Kevin Book, Managing Director of Clearview Energy Partners and a non-resident senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Of course, we'd love to hear from you. What's your solution for America's energy future? How are we going to meet this rising demand? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. George on Facebook says energy efficiency is the solution. The cleanest and cheapest energy is the energy you don't use. So let's get to your first big idea, Sonia, and it has to do with energy siting.
Yeah.
Which sounds wonky, but is actually, I think, pretty easy for people to understand once we dig into it. Break it down.
Okay. Big fix. We need to do a better job at making sure that we can build the projects that we need to build. So Abe actually teed this up very nicely. We're thinking about solar and wind, for example, industrial scale. Well, we need to make sure that we can build it in the land spaces where it's viable. And I would argue that we haven't done a great job of thinking strategically through the process of siting, and we can do a lot better. The ways that I think we can do better, first, I think that we need to be careful about evoking NIMBYism as the biggest problem or barrier. Here I would contend, and also in my own research, I find that NIMBYism often isn't a knee-jerk reaction. It isn't an irrational kind of response to something being located near somebody. In fact, when people are faced with the possibility of a new project being developed within their community, they have oftentimes very genuine concerns about whether it will disrupt their sense of place, their sense of community, their view shed, their property values, or kind of their understanding of the overall landscape. And those are very rational thoughts about their local environment. They also have thoughts about the benefits and the drawbacks of this new technology, whether they have full information about it, whether they think that it will directly impact them, whether it will affect their health, for example. These are very real emotions and needs and sentiments. And so I would argue, first, to have good siting practices, we need to be a little bit more compassionate about the communities that might host
How
this
are we
new
not
energy
compassionate
infrastructure.
Now, like, where's the lack of compassion now?
Well, the lack of compassion, I mean, one of it comes to another thing that we need to do, which is better community engagement. I would say communities need to be involved from the inception of an idea all the way through the end of a project once it's built. And when we don't meaningfully engage communities, then we have a lack of compassion. If we just write them off and say, oh, well, they're just NIMBYs, then we have a lack of compassion. But instead, if we go into a community and say, this is real, this is your community, this is your sense of place, what do you need in order to accept the drawbacks of hosting this infrastructure?
So let's give an example, like a solar panel field or something like that. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I think a lot of people think they look ugly.
Some think they look
gorgeous. I know, sure. But so you're going to get that, right? Mm-hmm. When you propose that project in a community. It used to be farmland. Now it's solar panels. Mm-hmm. The benefit to me individually is like,
small.
Really, really small. And I think that's the case with a lot of these projects. Like, we all need it for the greater good. But for me in that community, mm-hmm. like, I don't really know what I'm getting mm-hmm. out of not getting a job. Mm-hmm. So how do you make the argument to that person in a compassionate way that there is something in it for them?
Well, if you own that land and the solar is going on your land, sure. then you can receive payments for it.
Right.
So you can also, so compensation, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think compensation, we need to have a broader view. It's not just financial compensation. It might be other forms of providing benefits and social values to these communities. So you can have direct compensation. The community can have compensation through some kind of tax revenue or even direct payments, even including throughout the duration of developing the projects and then beyond. But it might also be the fact that the community needs a new community center. They might need a new library, for example, or streetlights. And these are part of these negotiations that developers and local governments can have with the local community about what it is that they need in order to accept this new infrastructure.
And so how would this – so ultimately, like, if we were to implement some more compassion and working with community from the very beginning, how do you see this? Would it speed up the process? Would it how would it change things ultimately?
It might not speed up the process. It might slow down the process. Mm-hmm. However, if we approach the community late in the process, that could kill a project, right? Mm-hmm. We are seeing a lot of projects killed right now. Part of it is due to the kind of the federal pushback against solar and wind, which we've already talked about. But part of it is also due to an increased amount of local resistance to these projects. There are hundreds now of ordinances and new zoning laws that exist all across the United States that are banning new solar or wind. Mm-hmm. That's problematic if we need to build big and build it fast. And so addressing these early on in these individual communities, I think, could actually lead to the success of these projects.
But another way around that, right, is basically to disempower communities to mm-hmm. make it so they have fewer tools in their toolbox to stop projects. I mean, that's another way to go about this.
That's what some of the ordinances are, right? It's basically stripping the local residents from the ability to even choose.
Right.
It just outright bans them.
Yeah. So Kevin, I guess let me get your thoughts on this mm-hmm. debate. Like, do we need to just do a better job of approaching communities, bargaining with communities, or do we need to have a frank conversation about disempowering, overriding, railroading communities so that we can get the things built that we need built for the greater good?
Avi, this is one of the fundamental questions of our federalism, right? We have challenges all the way from the 10th Amendment forward on this front. How do you divide the greater good versus the local interest? A lot of the biggest problem is usually concern the midstream infrastructure that conveys supply to demand centers, so pipelines and transmission lines, especially because the folks in the middle don't derive direct benefit or don't feel like they do, and they bear a lot of the interference or the perceived interference with their lifestyle, their land. But in the end, there are a number of ways to do this. I mean, there are, first of all, regulatory mechanisms for cost allocation and benefit allocation. There are ways in which incentives can be structured so that participating players share. In Pennsylvania, for example, since you are in Pennsylvania, one of the interesting and innovative principles put to work was to create an impact fee around fracking sites. So the communities that bore the effective impact of the production received proceeds in greater proportion than the state going, than money going to state coffers and being apportioned through regular processes. So one of the things that energy projects do is they throw off revenues. Those revenues can be a tool for structuring public acceptance and accommodating concerns.
Abe, your thoughts on this, sort of which direction do we do? For Charles, do you agree we have to do a better job engaging local communities? And what do you think this sort of revenue sharing idea makes the most sense? Because that's kind of, to me, that sounds like, let's just get real with each other. We know you don't want this here. We know this looks bad. We know there are potential side effects of having solar panel or a pipeline under your house. Let's just give you a little money.
Mm-hmm. This is probably the hardest issue in energy policy, is how much power do you give to the local community? And you know, I can tell you, when I was with the state of New Jersey, we were trying to build offshore wind, and there were shore communities that were absolutely opposed.
Right.
And so there's this tremendous tension between overriding the local community and trying to work with them. But I will say, I think you need to start with working with them. That's, you know, there's absolutely no downside to doing that. And in a lot of cases, I actually think getting the local community on board can make the infrastructure get done faster than it otherwise would be. And, you know, when we talk to researchers who go out and survey community members, they often talk about, to your point, that not necessarily NIMBYism, but that the energy infrastructure doesn't fit the sense of place that these people have, that it doesn't fit in with the, you know, the water-based job infrastructure and community infrastructure. So what do we need to do? We need to go to those, you know, local fishermen and say, you know, currently there's no model for getting your son a job. He's going to leave the shore because there is no economic opportunity. Here's how we can create that and import the offshore wind
infrastructure. Do you worry this is ultimately a losing battle, though? Because there are countries on Earth, we don't need to say them by name, where basically this idea that you need to appease the local community almost doesn't even exist, or it exists at a much lower level.
So,
and those countries pretty clearly can build faster. And you talked about building fast.
Ultimately, like I said, this is probably the toughest issue we deal with. I tend to come down on the side that we need to give as much process as is appropriate to the local community. But ultimately, we may need to override their wishes.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, we potentially end up in a situation where every community says no. Or at least, let me refine that a little bit. Every community with the financial wherewithal
says no.
Says no. And so what do? You end up citing infrastructure in black and brown communities, poor communities, and we just don't have equity. So like one of the things that I think New York is doing right now that's super interesting is they are assigning obligations to host infrastructure on a geographic basis. Every county has to participate. It's up to the local county where they put it, but at least there's that requirement and it has to be equitable.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach. By the way, our question for you, our listeners, is this: what's your solution for America's energy future, and how are we going to meet rising demands? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the live chat. Look a bear on YouTube says, we should lean into cleaner energy for sure. If we have to build dumb data centers, can't they at least use solar? And so we want to move on. You say yes.
Yes.
You say yes. And so we want to move on to our second round of the Big Fix ideas. And Abe, we're coming back to you because your second idea is a $1 trillion grid glow up.
Absolutely.
Lay it out. What is what is this glow up? How would it work?
I would like $1 trillion.
Think I want $1 trillion too. Lay it out for us, Abe.
So we are looking at adding entire cities worth of new electricity to serve AI data centers over the next 5 years. You know, the AI industry is kind of like your toddler when you ask them what they want to be when they grow up. They're like, I want to be an astronaut, art teacher, or professional soccer player, mm-hmm. right? Like any one of those would be amazing. And data centers want to do it all. So they're coming in and telling us that they need so much more electricity than what we're making today. And they want us to pay for it. Now, so we're talking, you know, and I mean, it's easy to throw around big numbers. We're talking somewhere between $1 and $5 trillion in new grid investment that's going to be necessary over the next 5 to 10 years to accommodate these data centers. And I think the big question is, where is that money going? And are we investing it in a long-term, sustainable, clean grid? Or are we just going to kind of go back and kind of do it the way we're doing it now, build a lot more fossil fuel infrastructure?
So what's the glow up?
The glow up is use the data center balance sheets to fundamentally revamp the grid. Mm-hmm. And that means putting in new technologies on the grid. Like right now, most of our transmission lines are dumb. When you see a line going down the road next to the highway, that line doesn't really talk to anybody. It's kind of a loner. But we now have the technology to come in and put all sorts of electronic sensors on those grids to replace the cable with a cable that it conducts more electricity. And there's all these things that we can do to bring technology. It also means we're going to need new infrastructure. We're going to need a lot more power plants. You know, you think about...
So your argument is, because we have to spend these trillions anyway, we might as well just get what we really need to make it very futuristic.
Absolutely. And part of this is also, all right, big tech.
Yeah.
You are making a lot of money right now. You're the ones who are really causing the need for all this new infrastructure. How about you help us out?
So Microsoft is going to pay for us to make a smarter grid.
Absolutely. Yes. And you know...
you agree,
Sam? Yes. Yeah, totally. Science on board with this.
Well, and let me
but
say,
that's going to... And I'm going to say slow down, but that's going to raise the cost, right? And that means you're going to have to get...
More money.
You know, that's going to scare off some investors if we say now it's going to cost the investor more, right?
I'm going to say it's actually exactly the opposite.
Okay.
To build a big new transmission line that requires new right-of-way, all those problems we were talking about, siting and permitting, takes a decade. That is a really expensive proposition. If we can come in and put in new technology or replace the line we have now on the existing right-of-way or even shrink that right-of-way, that is so much cheaper. And, you know, not only do I expect there'll be a consensus.
Wait. So Microsoft can pay money and make something cheaper? Of course they would do that.
Absolutely.
But you're sure they can do that?
Well, they can absolutely. It will be cheaper than the alternative of rebuilding the dumb grid or expanding the dumb grid.
Yeah.
And so is this just a must? Sonia, let me get you in. Is this an idea of just we just have to make the case better to the tech companies that if they give us the money to make a smarter grid, that they will be the ones saving money in the long term along with the rest of us? We have to make that argument to them, and that's a legitimate argument to make?
I think it's a perfectly legitimate argument. I mean, I don't understand why data centers are allowed to develop in a way that just shifts all of the burden onto the energy sector, and I'll also argue our education sector, right? For us to figure out how to solve this problem, why not, as they are developing and pouring massive amounts, I mean, a third of our GDP is propped up by these investments right now, as this much money is flowing into the sector, I think it's perfectly appropriate to say, okay, well, help us with the solution.
Now, if I'm at Microsoft, I'm going to say, Kevin Book, show me the map.
Yeah.
Like, you want me, maybe I'm willing to pay for it, and maybe you can get me to pay for it just because you've got leverage over me. Let's put that aside. But if you want me to pay for it with the idea that I'm going to be saving money in the long term by allowing you to make these electrical upgrades, show me the math. Is the math there, Kevin?
There's a challenge intrinsic to the data center build out and the energy it requires. And that challenge is the timescale mismatch between tech cycles and the investment in energy infrastructure, which lasts decades. Tech cycles turn over 18 months, a couple of years.
Yep.
And you don't know necessarily that you want to own something with 50 or 70 year life when you've got maybe quantum computers 10 years down the road.
Yeah. So let's back to you then. I think you have to do that. That is a challenge, right?
Absolutely.
Let's not use Microsoft again. Let's use another one. Let's use Apple. Let's use Amazon, whatever. They're going to be saying like, look, I'm in an investment cycle. I'm in a technology cycle of 12 months to 18 months. You're telling me this is going to pay off how many years down the road? Like, am I really all that interested in bargaining with you over that? So how would you convince them, I suppose?
Let's be absolutely clear. The current system is that we, mom and pop consumers, are subsubsidizing the big tech build out.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I think we all agree that that needs to end. And in fact, I mean, it's not just us. The White House, President Trump, and the National Energy Dominance Council, and all 13 governors in our region, including Governor Shapiro on a bipartisan basis, all came together and said that the free ride for data centers has to end. Mm-hmm. Like, so if they are going to come onto the grid, they need to bring their own generation. They need to pay for all the transmission upgrades they require. And I mean, I can think of literally no other issue in civic discourse today where Governor Shapiro and President Trump and Secretary Wright, of the Energy Secretary,
are on the
agree
same
on
side.
Something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, I agree with the Trump administration on this. That's a very narrow set of issues. But we have this emerging bipartisan national consensus that data centers need to pay their own way. And so, you know, back to why are they going to do it? Not necessarily because it's going to save them money over doing nothing, but because their social license, their ability to actually build right. these data centers is being impeded right now because people hate them.
Yeah.
And part of the reason they hate
them. And
people
would like them more.
They want the political wind to become a political gale.
Absolutely.
Get on board. I got it. Okay, so we're going to come back soon and talk more solutions. Sonia and Kevin have their final two solutions to offer, and we're getting a lot of great comments from you. Hopefully we'll read some of those on the other side of this break. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. On this Big Fix episode, we're talking about the challenges that surging energy demands is putting on our grid, including AI data centers and global industrialization.
We're debating solutions with three energy experts. They've each brought two big ideas to the table. With us are Sonia Carley, professor and faculty director of the Kleinman Center for Energy Policy and vice provost of climate at the University of Pennsylvania. We also have Abe Silverman, research scholar with the Ralph O'Connor Sustainable Energy Institute at Johns Hopkins. He was the former general counsel for the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities. And finally, Kevin Book, who is managing director of Clearview Energy Partners and a non-resident senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Yes, and listeners, we want to hear from you as well. Our questions are, what's your solution for America's energy future, and how are we going to meet rising demand? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube and Facebook streamers, you can keep those comments coming in the chat. We have Brian who wrote in, who says, only fossils care about fossil fuels. This administration will cause the U.S. to fall behind the rest of the world when it comes to clean green energy production and the developments in new technologies. Ruth from Chester County says, I think there should be an intense research program to make computers far more energy efficient than actually look at how many data centers we need. Maybe we are giving too much of our resources to something we probably don't need or really want.
Kevin, I want to give you a chance to present your second idea. We kind of ended up flipping yours. We ended up doing the pendulum proofing idea already. But your first idea you already alluded to as well, which is depoliticizing energy. And I love the idea. I think we probably all want to depoliticize a million things, but we don't know how to do it because it seems like everything in this society gets increasingly political. So help us understand how we might at least begin to approach that.
Sure, Avi. And part of it comes down to why it makes sense when you think about the investment and the companies that are making that investment. Increasingly, a lot of the companies we're talking about are energy companies that do a lot of different types of energy work. So when we talk about offshore wind, a lot of the companies in question that were facing project cancellations were also companies with competencies in offshore oil and gas that had moved into offshore wind as a consequence of that experience. And so it's a little bit weird to have one party deciding to celebrate one type of technology or fuel and another party oppose it and vice versa, because the companies don't work that way. The molecules don't work that way. The resources don't work that way. And our commingled consumption of energy across the grid, across the pipes, doesn't work that way. So one of the things that we've seen in the last few years that is a little distressing for investors is that tax policy, which plays such a big role in energy policy writ large, has flip-flopped very, very vigorously. So the Inflation Reduction Act, nearly $1 trillion or more over 10 or 15 years of a lot of it tax credits for development of clean energy, essentially rolled back by the big, beautiful bill, And that kind of flux makes investment very, very difficult. But what made it possible in the first place for the Inflation Reduction Act to go so green and for Republicans to yank the green energy leash so hard in the big, beautiful bill was basically there was no bipartisanship involved. Mm-hmm. What happened was using a wonky part of the legislative process, something called a budget reconciliation bill, one party was able to push their ideas without opposition or amendment from the other. And so I think that when we look at the process, we can change the process. Last thing I'll say about this is when we look at the committees and the way their jurisdiction is divided in our Congress, it's a little bit strange that they aren't the same, first of all, in the House and Senate. They have different committees with different jurisdictions, and that we've separated and disaggregated to some extent the environmental and the energy investment decisions, which you could probably restructure this, and it won't be easy, but to think about it more holistically, because we should be looking at it holistically.
Yeah, it sounds like you're really talking about, you're addressing this issue that that we keep coming back to, this dysfunction within Congress, this dysfunction among our lawmakers. I mean, how do we get the political will to address something like this? Because, you know, we've been losing time, we've been losing money. I think about all the waste and the billions of dollars lost as investment started with the wind energy, and then that was yanked and clawed back and it ended. So how do we create a moment where this becomes a priority for Americans, where we can sort of deal with this dysfunction in Congress?
Proactively or reactively? And most of the time we've done it in the latter category. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we may find ourselves, I don't want to say this because it's not exactly the most optimistic thing, but when we look at the hole in global inventories that's been created by the Hormuz crisis, we are looking at something that could be a little bit bigger than just high prices. So we may find ourselves in a moment where we need to rethink our policy and our process and our partisanship.
Mm. Sometimes crisis can spur action. I want, Sonia, to give you a chance to get to your second big idea. Which is, you even say, is unsexy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important. Rate reform.
Rate reform.
Okay, rate reform.
Oh, that's sexy.
How, yeah.
Is it?
Abe thinks it's sexy.
For those of us in the room,
small group.
How are we reforming the rates? What's wrong with the rates? Go ahead.
What's wrong with the rates? Everything's wrong with the rates.
Okay.
We need to do a better job with rate reform, with designing our rates both for the suppliers, for the utility companies, but also for consumers and what they face. We are in an affordability crisis. I don't think we've thrown out these numbers. Energy prices have increased 30% over the last 5 years. Some say it's up to 40%, and it's much bigger in some places. Here in PJM, they've increased 20% in the last year. Mm-hmm. People are paying 20% more on their bills in a particularly cold winter, right? So
yep.
we all felt it.
This
is a problem. And part of the problem is that our rates are designed and they're set in this regulatory structure where utility companies are allowed to invest in what they think is appropriate. Oftentimes it's heavily in capital investments, and then they're given a rate of return for those investments. So this sets up this incentive for overinvestment in capital and underinvestment in things like energy efficiency and innovation.
What do they build too much of?
Mm-hmm. Large centralized power plants. Natural gas plants,
yeah,
is an example.
And what do they not build enough of?
They don't invest enough in energy efficiency,
yeah,
to take two pretty polar examples.
And so what would be an investment in energy efficiency, I guess, that they could be making that they have no incentive to make?
They could invest in energy efficiency programs. They could invest in demand-side management programs, essentially where large industrial consumers or even residential consumers essentially can opt into a program where their energy is curtailed when they need to use less because the grid is more strained.
Mm-hmm.
But those are things that utility companies might not be keen to do. And instead, they want to just spend more capital.
So how do you shift their focus?
How do you shift? It's through rate design. And so there's multiple ways. One is by creating performance incentives or yardsticks, where essentially you say, this is the ideal, this is the best, or here's an example of utility that's doing a phenomenal job. How do you measure up? And mm-hmm. then you give the incentives, you actually give payback for the investment in cleaner, more efficient, more advanced kinds of investment.
Yeah. And take some of the issues, Sonia, that we've been seeing recently among energy companies. We've seen a lot of electric companies like PECO, for example, that had these huge revenue returns. At the same time, consumers are feeling the pinch because they felt their rates go up and they're paying more and more and more every single year. And so how do you take a company like that and lean on them to, keep to more efficiently use the money that they're generating.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. PICO actually just withdrew their request for large rate increases as a result of some of the pressure in some of these conversations about the affordability crisis. Let me shift, actually, if I may, to the consumer side. So how do we help protect consumers? Well, one, I would say we could just be more efficient in pricing or showing a price to consumers by having prices that actually vary by the resources that are available or that are being deployed to the grid at any given location in any given time. But I'll also say that we need to be mindful of those consumers that really perpetually struggle to pay their energy bills. Oftentimes, these are lower income consumers because they, of course, have very tight budget constraints and they're constrained in their ability to buy food and housing and healthcare and energy. But this also increasingly is including a larger proportion of the population as prices are going up. And we also know that there's vulnerable households that struggle more to pay their energy bills, such as households with young children or households with people who rely on medical electronic medical devices. So here, when it comes to rate reform, I would argue that we need to be more thoughtful about providing income capped rates, for example, to households, or allowing the amount that they pay to fluctuate with their income as a percentage of their income, and to provide arrearage management programs, which are essentially debt forgiveness programs. We just need to be more creative in helping our energy insecure population.
And
be able to pay their
bills.
Who
would end up paying the most, the bulk here? Because if you're shifting, if you're capping it for some folks, other folks who may feel like, you know, they never get a break and that they would actually be carrying the burden. So who would be most impacted negatively by something like that?
Yeah, well, in current design, it would probably be those of the next tier up, essentially, of struggling to pay their bills, middle income. If we were to be very thoughtful about the way that we design it, we could come up with a more progressive situation where there is a degree of cross-subsidization from larger industrial consumers, for example, data center consumers, or more, you know, higher income households.
I want to read, this goes back to something we were talking about earlier, but it's a good comment. I want to read it from Matt. Matt says, I'm so tired of hearing about backlash against development. My community built a high school on a lead battery waste dump in 1971. We didn't know the impacts at that time. The impact of a cancer cluster is what it is, and covering up the only conceivable choice for many local school and municipal administrators. And I'll fast forward a little bit. Matt says, come on, regulations exist for a reason. Yes, let's make them reasonable, but not pretend they are unnecessary obstructions to progress. There's another email I wanted to get to here from Bill, who is talking about something called deep fission. We don't have to go into all the details, but what was so interesting to me in reading all of your guys' ideas, which we've gotten through all of them now, is that no one was like talking about some sort of futuristic energy generation technology, cold fusion. I don't know this much about deep fission, but like, I'm just curious, like, why, Abe? Like, why didn't your head go to, like, let's invest in some pie in the sky idea that could someday kind of just solve all our problems?
Because we have everything we need today. We do not need a new miracle technology. Solar and batteries are generally the cheapest thing, the fastest thing that we can add to the grid. Yeah, sure. Would it be wonderful if we had a, an infinite energy generation machine, fission, whatever you want? Yeah, that would be great. That would be nice. Make our jobs a lot easier. But we don't need it. And, you know, just to kind of wrap these two kind of comments we're talking about, there are things like grid enhancing technologies, which are, again, making those power lines smarter. Mm-hmm. And currently, the utilities only see upside if they tear down the existing lines and rebuild new ones, because they earn, the more they spend, the more they earn. So back to this rate design question, absolutely, we can reform our rates to make sure that the utilities are getting financially rewarded when they do the things we want them to do. And I think there's a lot of these things that are bipartisan as well. Mm-hmm. Like, we go around talking to state legislators, and I think you're seeing a lot of leadership at the state level on this, about, hey, can we make our power lines smarter? Everybody wins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, and then we also have this bipartisan consensus, largely both at the state and federal level, about making sure that the data centers are paying their own way. And, you know, a lot of these cost increases that we are all experiencing, I happen to be a New Jersey ratepayer, I'm seeing 20% year over year bill increases as well, is because of the data centers. And so we need to make sure both that the data centers are coming in and making us whole for the cost we've already paid. Yeah, good luck on that. But to make sure that we utilize that data center capital and that they are paying future rate increases. And then once we get them and we have, you know, some access to the investment, the huge investment dollars that they can deploy in some of these smart next generation technologies, where we do have, everybody loves that technology. Hey, Republican, Democrat, we're all on board with that. Reducing siting and permitting burden by repowering our existing grid. Everybody loves that. We could do it in a way that's cost saving for everybody.
Yeah. And Kevin, we have about a minute left in the show. Just want to get your thoughts about this moment, as Abe was talking about, and your thoughts on Sonja's proposal about rate fixes. I mean, how do you capitalize on this moment in time where there's a lot of opportunity with data centers, but there's a lot of demand and cost is growing fast?
Cherry, I'm encouraged by the fact that we're having this discussion on your show right now. That means that we've gotten outside the confines of the wonky rooms where people who specialize in this stuff are thinking about it. Now we're all thinking about it. And yes, it is a crisis to see power rates rising so rapidly. Yes, it is a challenge, particularly for the lowest income households. But it means that we're now at a moment where we actually have a motivation to get through the logjam and try to solve it. I will say that we shouldn't overlook what we've got. I think Abe's absolutely right. And one of the things we've got a lot of is still oil and gas. It has a place, it has a purpose, and we're living a lot better because we've developed that resource. Pennsylvania's developed that resource than a lot of places in the world are right now.
Thank you so much, Kevin Book, Managing Director of Clearview Energy Partners. Let me also thank Abe Silverman, Research Scholar from Johns Hopkins, and Sonja Carley, Professor and Faculty Director at the University of Pennsylvania. Appreciate all your insights this hour on Studio 2.
Oh, yes. Love that. Love that. And I have to say thank you to everybody who wrote in today, as well as a big thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Murray Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Adam Staniszewski and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We'll talk to you tomorrow.